Now, today, we are in for a special treat. Our guest is, if I may say so, one of the world's favorite humans, and certainly one of mine. Simply trying to outline the list of his accomplishments would take more time than we have today, so I'll resort to the official bio, cop-out, and say he is an English actor, broadcaster, comedian, television host, columnist, audiobook reader, and a prolific writer. He is also a noted memoirist, technophile, gadget guru, myth maven, language lover, insatiably curious, prodigiously prolific, and despite being the sort of polymath whose output dwarfs that of most mere mortals, rather than being odiously intimidating, he is invariably kind, generous, and generally speaking, lovable. That's probably because he's so damn funny and consistently quite interesting. So without further ado, I'm happy to welcome the one and only Stephen Fry. And Stephen, if you'll permit me, indeed, you are the visible personification of absolute perfection.
Oh, Brian, almost any word I utter from now on will be a disappointment after a build-up like that. But I thank
you. Not possible. Not possible. You know, I had a little bit of a challenge preparing for this. I normally try to sort of master the life arc and career accomplishments of our guests. And you have been so prolific in so many different directions that I was left a bit at sea. So I'm going to suggest that we take on the pose of conversational flaneur, so to speak, and wander about hither and yon and just see what we might stumble across along the way, if that's all right with you.
Good plan. I like it.
Okay. I know you're very busy, but in your case, that word goes to almost ridiculous extremes. On IMDb right now, they show 9 credits for you in 2024 and 9 upcoming as an actor, 2 upcoming as a producer, and 1 as a writer. So I'd like to start maybe by talking about 2 of your current and recent projects. One is the film Treasure. And also, finally, The Liar is coming to the screen, I see. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about each of those projects.
Well, I can tell you a lot about Treasure, which is a film. About The Liar film, I can tell you very little because it's a peculiarity of mine, I suppose, but I don't think unique amongst people who've written novels, that if someone is kind enough to think that they can make it into a film, I give it to them whole and have nothing to do with it. It's partly for their sake, but it's more, of course, for mine. It's a strange thing when you release a novel, all the cliches about parturition sort of apply. You do feel you've given birth and that the thing you want it to be its own entity. And if someone else wants to say, I want to take it over now, you kind of go, well, that's fine. I've done my bit for it. Now you do yours. So I hope it's going well and I hope it's gone well, but I literally know nothing about how it is. I know they'll be in touch with me when it's ready for screening and I'll go along like an ordinary audience member. But Treasure is a film I was involved with last year. It was a German production. Julia von Heinz is the director. She's a magnificent German director. And this is the third of her films, which explore the deeply difficult question of the relationship of the present generation to the Holocaust. And I received this script and was instantly transfixed by the fact that the character they'd asked me to look at, whose name is Edek in the story, which is based on a novel by Lily Brett, the Australian-American writer. And this character, Edek, just from almost the first page of the dialogue, small as it was, brought my grandfather into my head. The story is set in about 1990, towards the end of communism in Pola, the rise of Solidarność, and so on. And I play a character who was a survivor of Auschwitz, who was born in Poland, lived in Łódź, which is how we pronounce that city that is spelled LLODZ, but it's actually pronounced Łódź, and was a very big Jewish center. He was in the ghetto when the Germans first invaded, and then the ghetto was emptied as they so often were, and he was taken to Auschwitz along with his new wife, and they were separated. Fortunately, they were both young and fit enough to survive because they were workers, and so they took part in the slave labor, and when the camp was liberated, they then had the problem of escaping the Soviets, but they somehow managed to leave and go to New York. In New York, they have a child. The wife sadly dies, so he raises this daughter, Ruth, and in the film, she's played by the wonderfully talented and brilliant Lena Dunham, creator of the HBO series Girls, you may remember. And anyway, the story is that she, having grown up, wants to visit Poland and wants to stand in her parents' footsteps. And I, of course, and I think I understood this from the beginning of the script, I could see Edek's point of view because it seemed so reasonable to her. I want to find my roots, you know. There's a TV show called that in America, you know, and finding your roots. And it's a natural thing. Let's go to where my parents were born. Let's, you know. But can you imagine surviving Auschwitz and all that does to your soul? Because to be a survivor of Auschwitz is not just having plucked a lucky ticket. You have to do something to survive in that place. You have to close off a part of your humanity, probably, because everything around you is so grotesque, and you don't want to be one of those who is weak. And so, you know, you become a different sort of person, and you see things that have just, you know, human beings shouldn't see, shouldn't know, shouldn't experience. Terrifying things. And you amazingly escape from all that. You get to New York, you know, the Lady Liberty, the very symbol of freedom, choice, of the availability and prosperity of the place is just astounding. And you're also surrounded by other Jewish people who can make you feel at home, and that you're not constantly going to be moved on like your parents were, and their parents and their parents, and so on. And then this daughter, you grow up, she's a New Yorker. Hey, I've got an American daughter, and she's smart. She's a journalist. She's interviewed the Rolling Stones once in a magazine. And then she just says, I want to go to Poland. And I don't want her to go alone because I still think of it as the place that some Poles, obviously the minority, but some were pretty nasty to the Jews. There's no question. Many of them also went to Auschwitz, and you know, they suffered enormously. Their country was invaded, but you know, there were stories, including the story of in this book, of people moving into the houses that were vacated by Jews and then not wanting to give them up, and indeed harming the Jews who came back after all the problem of surviving the death camps and the death marches. Suddenly they're killed by the house owners. There are stories of that. So, you know, he's just, I don't want my daughter to go to that place. I don't want her to go alone, but I don't want to go myself. Now, it all sounds very serious, but Edek, the character, like my grandfather, who was a Hungarian Jew, not a Polish Jew, was one of those arms open, stretching, warm, funny people who embrace life. It's one of the sort of options, as it were, not a conscious option, but one of the ways you can respond to the kind of persecution and horror that you experience in the war. One of the ways could be, as I say, to embrace life. Other ways it closed down and never to trust. But yeah, my grandfather was the sort of person like Edek who, you know, you get out of the car to go to a restaurant, and then just as you were going into the restaurant, you'd think, where's Grandpa? Where's he gone? And you'd see that he was in deep conversation with a traffic warden. And he would say, you must meet Edek. He is the traffic warden. And he's a wonderful man. He's brilliant. He has two children. One plays the violin, you know. And you're thinking, Grandpa, why? It's so embarrassing, you know. But it's actually a charming thing, as well as, for the young, deeply alarming. Anyway, it's a very long answer to your question, but that's what appealed to me. A, that it connected to my family. My mother's family, at least, were Central European Jewish, and and my grandfather, fortunately, was in England in the 30s with my grandmother, who was from Vienna. But their parents, it's all four of my great grandparents on that side, perished in the camps, and many other, and their children, many others as well. So my and then others who survived went either to Israel or to New York, in fact. So, you know, there was, and anybody with Jewish blood in their veins has a story like it, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, But it just, I love the fact that it was about the father-daughter relationship, that it's such a special thing.
Yes.
And that it was about what we now call transgenerational trauma, the fact that, you know, one generation can actually undergo the trauma, but and they think once it's over, I'm tough, it's happened, thank goodness. They don't think it will be carried on to their children. Why should it? They didn't suffer it. But actually, it's very apparent it can happen a great
right.
deal.
And I haven't had the chance to see it yet, but I've read a good deal about it. It seems as well, one of the most moving things about it is how this father and daughter basically managed to find a meeting place through this reliving of a horrible experience. Yeah. But he is doing everything he can to deflect and avoid and circumvent and joke his way and
yes.
seemingly sabotage what for her is supposed to be a revelatory experience, and somehow she's feeling like he's not taking it seriously, but in fact quite the opposite is the case. It's so serious that it's unbearable. Is that right. a fair way of describing it?
Very good summation. And yeah. it is, for some part of it, the relationship is quite comic. And so every description I've given of the film wouldn't lead you to that thought, but actually human life is like that. Yeah, he deflects the seriousness, and it's only towards the end that he's finally able to kind of break down, really, and they come to a new relationship, and it's deeply touching, I hope, and it certainly felt it so making it. I mean, you know, it's not a big Hollywood movie. It's and it's one of the more enjoyable movies to make, really, which is, it was a Polish and German crew, and it was small enough not to be a great behemoth, you know, juggernaut of logistics. And I got on so well with everybody, especially with Lena, which was so important. We just instantly hit it off. And
yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hope everyone is going to make a point of seeing it. Now, you've done just about everything. You even created a contemporary libretto for Kenneth Branagh for The Magic Flute, and you've also hung out with Komodo dragons. What on earth were you thinking of hanging out with Komodo dragons? But one thing for me actually really stands out, aside from everything else, and it's the sheer amount of television you've done. You must hold the Guinness record for having had the most series of any human alive. I'm just looking at the list, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing because, you know, it'll take forever. But, you know, from Blackadder, A Bit of Fry and Laurie, Jeeves and Worcester, QI, Kingdom. You're even doing Jeopardy now, I understand.
Yes, that's Les Majestés against the great Canadian, of course, Alex Trebek. But that came about in a very sort of Hollywood way, really. I was in L.A. Doing a guest appearance in a few episodes of the Apple TV's The Morning Show. Mm-hmm. And my agent over there invited me to eat one evening that I wasn't shooting. And we were just having a general chat, as you do with your agent. And he said, what do you guys do when you're not, you know, when you're not called on set? And I said, well, you know, my husband's name is Elliot. So Elliot and I, we're pretty homebodies, really. We don't go to Hollywood parties and that sort of thing. We'll just tend to have an early supper and maybe watch Jeopardy or something. And he said, oh, do you guys like Jeopardy? And I said, yeah, we absolutely love it. I'm kind of addicted to it, to be honest. I just think it's the greatest quiz show I've ever seen. It's, the format is just endlessly rewarding, and I love it. And he said, do you watch it in the UK? And I said, well, we don't have it in the UK. He said, why? I said, no, isn't that ridiculous? I've never understood why not, but we just don't. Then the conversation moved along. But Hollywood agents are Hollywood agents. 2 weeks later, he calls up and says, British TV, very excited by the idea. You want to do Jeopardy over there. You want to host it. I said, excuse me. I don't remember saying that. He said, oh, you don't want to host it, but they're very keen. They'll do it. And I said, well, oh, God. Give me some time to think about it. So I chatted about it to Elliot and to various others. And they said, you know, they said, well, where's the harm? You like the show? It's a good show. It's a quiz. It's not too difficult. You know, you won't be selling your soul to do that. It's a classy show. And I agreed. And I thought it would be fun. As long as we kept the core values of the show, you know, that didn't try and sort of alter the format or cheapen the questions, make them too easy or something, because it's, you know, part of the pleasure is the joy you get from watching these astoundingly smart people. It's you know, full of, you know, and some of them, they're not all academics or anything.
No.
So we did it. And indeed, the first really great champion we had over several days was a boy of about 17 whose father was a bus driver. So it was really, we couldn't have devised a better opening for it to show people. And we did a limited season of 25. You know, we didn't, you know, the network didn't immediately say, we'll do it like it is in North America with, you know, once an evening of all 5 weekdays with extra celebrities at the weekend and, you know, champion of champions. We'll slowly get the British public used to it. And it did well for its time slot, which was an afternoon, which is a big thing for quizzes in England for some reason. It did okay. So I enjoyed that. Mad, isn't it?
Well, no, it's wonderful, actually. And I have to say, Jeopardy is the only show in North America that can allow us to retain a sense of non-intimidation compared to such British shows as My Word, Just a Minute, and QI, in terms of the level of knowledge and intellectual dexterity that's called upon from the guests. So it seems like a natural fit for the UK. But my maiden point was, so much television, bloody much television. Are you especially drawn to the medium compared to, let's say, feature films?
Yes, and the difference is in television. I can do some series where I'm an actor, which I enjoy, but also I can, you know, slake my restless curiosity with documentaries. You mentioned the Komodo Dragon, and that was really the result of a friendship with the late and much missed Douglas Adams, the author of the Hitchhiker books. And he also spent a year away with a natural historian called Mark Carwardine, looking at disappearing species in the 80s, species that were on the verge of extinction, and trying to understand why there was so much of this going on. And as you know, this is hardly reduced. So 20 years later, as a sort of anniversary of the book, Mark and I, Douglas having died in 2001, I think it was, really sad. We followed in his footsteps to see which of the creatures that he was looking at had survived and some hadn't. The Yangtze River dolphin, for example, a freshwater Chinese dolphin, had become completely extinct. Others, like the in New Zealand, the kakapo, the flightless nocturnal parrot, were down to about 20 left on Earth. And the white rhinoceros, the northern white rhino, was down to a very small number and is now down to one, I think, because I made a separate later program about the northern white rhino, and we actually translocated a male white from a zoo in Prague, of all places, where he'd been collected from Sudan, so his name was Sudan, and we took him back to a conservancy in Kenya, in order to see if he could possibly have a little bit of a relationship with one of the females left. And it was difficult. There are the genes and the sperm banks and everything have the species left, but ultimately it's functionally extinct. Anyway, so, and then was the ai in Madagascar, and freshwater Amazon manatee in Amazon. And it was an extraordinary adventure, and the Komodo dragon, right, which is in Indonesia. It was incredibly exciting. I love travel. I love going to places that, you know, are not on the tourist map. And I'm also extremely lazy about logistics and things, so I would never get it together to arrange it myself. So to have the BBC do it for you, it's a real luxury. It wasn't all, when I say luxury, it wasn't luxurious as an adventure. I mean, a lot of times we were camping in the jungle for days and days. But I surprised myself
by... You broke your arm.
And unfortunately, yes, when we were in Amazonia, as people will know, or if they don't, it's nice to sort of be told it, because it's kind of obvious and yet it isn't. If you're on the equator, every single day of the year, the sun rises at 6 o'clock and sets at 6 o'clock. There are no seasons. And so we were at 5:45 in Amazonia, going from one, and I had to move from the boat where we'd been sleeping into another boat. And I slipped and fell down onto the taffrail of the other boat and smashed my arm, my right arm, the humerus, a spiral fracture. And we were at a place where you don't measure your distance from civilization, if one can use that word, in miles or kilometers. You measure it in days. So we were 2 days from Manaus, the capital of Amazonia. So they sent an aeroplane that landed on the river and took me away. So it was a bit unfortunate. And then immediately, once I'd had a plate and 10 screws in the arm, I had to fly straight off to America to do the second leg of what was a long documentary I did in the United States, in which I visited every state in the Union, all 48 right. Contiguous on the continental landmass and Alaska and Hawaii to finish off with. So in the period when I was doing Louisiana all the way up the Mississippi to Wisconsin, I was in a sling. I had my arm in a sling.
Right. Well, at least when you visited the body farm, they didn't say, well, you look like you're not doing too well. Maybe you'd like to pay an extended visit.
Yes, Brian, I must tell that story because it's an example of how extraordinary a day's filming can be, where we are on the road. We decided early on that if I was going to go around America, how would I go? The cliche is for the Brit or the non-dom to go in a convertible Mustang or something, and the camera crews like the convertible side of it because it's so much easier to film the driver and film the scenery from a roofless car. But I thought, oh, it's just so tedious. I'm an Englishman going to America, so and as it happens in London, I drove for 25 years a black cab when I was in the city. I kept it in a lockup, and an ordinary citizen can buy a black cab, and you look exactly like an ordinary cabbie. So we had a black cab for me to drive around America, all 50 states, which was good fun. So one morning, we're in Asheville, North Carolina. That's Asheville, not Nashville. And it's a beautiful, beautiful city. It's an amazing place, really unusual. And it's on the fringes of the Blue Ridge and the Smoky Mountains. And it's absolutely stunning at that time of year, October, when we were filming. So in the morning, we filmed in a balloon going over these beautiful leaves that were, or as you say in Canada, leafs.
Leafs. Only the hockey players say that.
I know, yeah. But it was stunning. I mean, the sky was perfect, the air was crisp, and the smell even of the trees coming up from us as we sailed along in our balloon. It was so beautiful. And that kept from me what we were doing in the afternoon. We landed in someone's front garden. They were very hospitable, as so many Americans are, and they offered us coffee and buns and things. And then I got in the car with the cameraman and the director in the floor, in the seat behind. And he said, we're going now to Knoxville, Tennessee, which is, about 3 or 4, 5 maybe hours, which was nothing. I was getting used to the sizes you have in North America compared to Great Britain. And he said, as you know, we're going to the University of Tennessee there, the Knoxville campus. And I'm not going to tell you what to prepare for on this occasion. We've kept it out of the documents because I want to register your real response. But I know you'll be surprised and possibly, I'm going to use the word shocked, but I know you'll also be intrigued and curious, and I think you can take it. And I was thinking, what can he be talking about? I know you can take it. He's not going to put me in the football stadium and make me play a game of American football. You never know when you do these things. We were trying to, just get inside every aspect of American life we could.
Right.
So I drove along and did a bit of talking to cameras through the scenery and everything. And we arrived at Knoxville, and I was directed to this car park, and there was a great big chain-link fence, padlocked door, and a woman standing in front of it. I was introduced to her. Let's say her name was Pauline. I don't know what it was. I can't remember. And she welcomed me and asked me to put on a paper trousers and paper shoes. And I was thinking, this is a bit strange. And she opened the door in this chain link fence that said, keep out, and said, now, let me also put a little bit of this menthol and eucalyptus under your nose. I'm going, right, okay. And then I see the first one, a human body, a cadaver, a dead person lying stretched across the grass, but burned, horribly burnt, charcoal burned. I entered that place having never seen a human body in my life, and I left it having seen hundreds. It's known colloquially as the body farm. It's the active site of research for the forensic anthropology department of the university, and it was the first of its kind to encourage people to leave their bodies for scientific research in the forensic way. Now, for example, you've probably seen CSI, the original series in Las Vegas. Billy Peterson, the actor, played Gus Grissom, Grissom, he was known as. And his speciality was telling the time of death of cadavers that were discovered by the larvae of insects that were hatching and growing in them. And you could have a precise calendar of death because each species has a very different time of coming to a body and breeding it. So on. It's all very grim. And this was something discovered at this place by the first researchers there. And let's say you kill someone in your family. It's the most common form of murder. You then leave their body because it's, you know, there's no one coming to visit you, and you go to a bar and get steaming drunk, and then you come back and think, oh my God, what am I going to do? You put it in the trunk of your car, the boot of the car, as we would say, wrapped in a carpet, and you drive to the woods and you dig it at night at 3 a.m, whatever, you bury it, you cover it up, you go home, next morning you get up, you hoover your car, you know, you vacuum your car out perfectly, you think you've got away with it. I'm quoting that as an example because it's one of the most common forms of manslaughter, of murder, homicide you can come across. Now, at each stage of that, different things happen to the body. So they repeat that. Someone leaves their body to science for this research. They will leave the body for a day. Then they will wrap it in a carpet and put it in the trunk of a car in different temperatures for different times. They've got, you know, because they do this multiple times. And then later they go and bury it. And they learn all the signs and signals that these bodies give off about the experience they've been through. They're fantastically respectful. All the time, the bodies were referred to as individuals. This individual has been kept in a house in this temperature. This one has been burned. This one was put in a dumpster and the lid was on and it's been there for... And that was the worst sight I've ever seen, this pool of liquid and bone sticking out of it and a smell that I described on camera at the time because I just said, Satan has crawled up my nostril and is clawing his way into my brain and I'll never be the same again. Because that's how I felt, and my respect for these academics who were quiet and respectful but had learned so much. And as a result, because this way of doing things is spread around the world, even in places that have no relationship with America, like Russia and China and so on, they use these techniques and they are available freely to the police forces, and the results and the data that flow from them. And she's saying thousands of people have been put to justice because of it, and thousands of people have been exonerated because of it. It is, you know, as my old friend David Frost used to say, it's the Lord's work you're doing here. And so that was a heck of a day, from the beauty of the ballooning to the horror of the bodies.
And you retained your lunch.
I somehow managed to retain my lunch. I do know people who, even if you say or refer to something while they're eating, it puts them off. There is nothing you can say to me or show me while I'm eating that would put me off, I'm afraid, such as my appetite.
Well, you've written now 3 books on mythology. The fourth, the final one, Odyssey, is to come this September, which makes it perfectly time for me to get a nice birthday present. My dearest one will hear this, and she will take due note, I believe. This is actually the next one. Odyssey is going to be the first one with a strong Roman element in it, because you're dealing with the Aeneid as well as the Odyssey, correct?
Yes. If I had my way, I would probably call the book Nostos, but I am aware that that would come across as pompous, and also that publishers would just never buy that. There's a great story about the person we call Vladimir Nabokov, but Martin Amis, the late lamented Martin Amis, who was a huge admirer of him, always used to say, it's actually Vladimir Nabokov. So Vladimir Nabokov, his marvelous, sparkling and brilliant memoir, autobiography, is called Speak, Memory. And his original title for it that he was determined was Speak Mnemosyne, Mnemosyne, who is the Greek goddess or titaness, who was the goddess of memory, the word mnemosyne, as in our word mnemonic. And she was the mother of the nine muses. And the publisher said to him, Vladimir, you cannot call it Speak. You cannot have the title of a book, which is a word that people either don't know or can't pronounce. In this case, it's both. We just call it Speak Memory. And he finally, I knew I would have a battle if I called it Nostos. But Nostos is a great word. It's the word behind the Odyssey. It's the Greek word for that feeling of need to be home. The deep, deep need and love of home, which is what resonates throughout the Odyssey, but also throughout the other stories of the Greeks. I mean, Achaeans, as Homer would call them, but we say Greeks these days because it's easier to know what we mean. Agamemnon had to get home, and you know, many will know what the story was of his Nostos, his homecoming, where Clytemnestra and her lover Aegisthus, his cousin, were there to meet him, and she couldn't forgive him for what he did to their daughter Iphigenia, and plus she was, you know, and so that was one story, which is of course covered in the trilogy of the Oresteia, yes, the plays by Aeschylus. But yes, there's also, as you rightly say, a Roman element, which is very important, the Nostos of the one Trojan figure who is still kind of alive and not a slave and not kind of skulking off to hide in obscurity. And that's the daughter of the goddess, the son of the goddess Aphrodite and Trojan Anchises, member of Priam's family, the king of Trojan. And his name was Aeneas. And Aeneas left bearing his father on his back in legend, and with his son and his wife and many other followers and in many ships, just as Odysseus was in many ships. And he had a very similar series of adventures. Only rather than going home, he was on a different sort of quest. He was making a home. He was leaving his home, Troy, and he eventually settled in Italy. And the great poem written about him, the Aeneid, which every schoolboy, at least of my generation and background, had to study, was the Roman equivalent of Odysseus isn't quite right. It was the foundational myth that was made into glorious Augustan poetry by Virgil in order to flatter both Augustus, who he somehow made that family related to Romulus and Remus and the offspring of Aeneas, and to give the Romans a sense of the destiny and the divine sanction and warrant for their great empire. And it is, one of the great works, and it is fascinating. And so I included that as well as Agamemnon and the homecoming of Menelaus and Helen, the casus belli, you know. Nostos would have been the word. We have Nostos, actually. It was in the 17th century, a Swiss doctor noticed that some soldiers, mercenaries in the 30 Years' War were pining away and even getting ill, seriously ill, to the point of death. And he could only attribute it to an acute form of homesickness. And he coined a word for it, which was the pain at home, the pain of not being at home, and that was nostalgia. And we have the word, of course, now. We tend to apply it to a time rather than a place. We're nostalgic for the 1960s, rather than nostalgic for home. But it was originally homesickness. And as I say, it is, I think, a very powerful thing. And so the book Odyssey that I've written, of course, the main hero is Odysseus, and the main heroine is Penelope, his wife back home in Ithaca. And the secondary, I suppose, is the marvelous Telemachus, their son, who
yes.
has his own journey, the Telemachy, as it's known, which is how the Odyssey begins. So I have more such fun retelling these stories. I mean, I loved retelling the Iliad in the third book, Troy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and adding other bits, because the Iliad actually only takes place over a few weeks. It's a very short period in what is a 10-year war. And the second, the first book was called Mythos, and is the birth of the gods and the creation of humankind and the interaction of the gods and nymphs with humans, the interbreeding, thanks to Zeus's randiness, shall we say. And then the second is called The Heroes. Oh, it was just called Heroes. And you have Hercules, that is, and Theseus and Jason and Bellerophon, Perseus. These are usually the children of gods, or at least of one god, and a human, it's as if their job in the mythological cycle, that the collective unconscious that created these myths always had a sense that once the world was full of dragons and monsters, and that they are no longer there, and there are interesting theories about that. One is that it's just, it's so common around the world that there was a time before us when there were beasts and some of our ancestors brought them down and killed them. And to me, one of the convincing arguments for that is that there are, as we know, all over the planet, signs of the dinosaurs and fossils. They're there in the United States, they're there in China, they're there in Britain, and in Canada, of course, and all over the place. And the first peoples of those countries, or the tribes who moved across them nomadically, whatever kind of people they were, it's impossible to imagine they wouldn't have seen the odd skull, the odd fossil, as we now know it to be. And why should they say, oh, this must be 150 million years old. There are no creatures like that. As soon as they saw it, they must have said, oh, my God, there are monsters here. Look at the size of them. And maybe they live in a cave around the corner. And then they wouldn't encounter them. And so they would start to tell stories of how they were defeated. They were defeated by brave and extraordinary people, perhaps, who are half gods themselves. It doesn't do it to be too convinced of one's interpretation of myth. It destroys the fine sense of it, the dreamlike quality. Joseph Campbell called myths public dreams, which is a rather good phrase, I think. But on the other hand, that is quite a convincing reason to imagine why there is such a such a commonality of dragons, as far as between China and the United States and Mexico or the Quetzalcoatl, and it's really interesting. And then after that, Troy and the Odyssey. So this is the fourth and final, because the cycle of Greek myths does seem to have a natural beginning and an end,
and a natural end, and it seems very appropriate to have the Aeneid, because it is almost like, the closing of one chapter and the opening of another era. The Romans very much saw themselves as the spiritual successors, but perfectors of the Greeks.
That's right.
It's almost as comparable to the way in biblical eschatology, there's this idea that there's a resonance of the Old Testament in the New, but the New basically makes things perfect that were left undone.
Yes, although there are a few rabbis that would disagree with that. But yes, we can see that. No, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting that in doing so, it again is in a new language, that rather than the Aramaic that we assume Christ himself would have spoken, the entire New Testament is actually in Greek. I'm not a believer myself, but I'm very interested in the Bible, and I read it, and I love that bit in Ephesians, Thessalonians, I suppose it must be, where Paul goes to Athens and disputes with philosophers there. Now, of course, it's the Hellenic age, which the Hellenist age, which is far, you know, far from Socrates, right, and Plato and so on. But nonetheless, there is still that tradition. They're on the Areopagitica, the Areopagitica. Such a difficult word to say. The Areopagitica is the work by Milton, but the Areopagus is the Hill of Mars, shall we say, which is where the Ecclesia met, which, you know, kind of neatly is where we get our word ecclesiastic, but it's where these bodies of lawmakers and trials were held in public amongst the voting members of the Athenian society, which didn't include slaves and women, of course, because we mustn't argue for perfection amongst the Athenians as far as our own morals are concerned. But, you know, they did what they did, and we have to penetrate that world and understand it. But St. Paul went there and started talking about Christ on the Areopagus, and he baffled they were very puzzled by this new way of thinking and talking. And it's quite a, I won't say comic section, but some of the epistles of Paul are quite amusing. You know, when he goes on about love and virtue and justice and building the church and behavior, and then says, I left my cloak at the house of Timothy's brother. Can it be returned to me, please? Those right. are my favorite bits.
Right. And of course, the outcome of the disputes are always a foregone conclusion, because he or she who chronicles the debate always coincidentally happens to be the winner of the debate.
Especially if it's someone like Paul, who, let's face it, right, you know, I don't think I would have got on with him as a
no. But I love mythology, and one of the reasons is because whenever I hear the stories, I get this little twinge in what might be my lizard brain, an appeal to something that's buried very deep within, a sort of Call of the Wild sensation. And I think, you know, if I'm not reading too much in for you, there's something special about the Greeks compared to, for example, the Norse, the Hindu, the myths of the indigenous people of the Americas, perhaps because it's just closer to us and our own lineage. But it does actually remind me the differences in tone, flavor, you know, the structure of the narratives of three memorable lines that I actually quoted when I chatted with Neil Gaiman in connection with his retelling of the Norse myths. And this is actually three lines from the American poet Wallace Stevens' poem, Loneliness in Jersey City. Perhaps you know it.
I'm trying to remember what the lines might be.
Well, the gods grow out of the weather. The people grow out of the weather. The gods grow out of the people.
Very good. Beautiful. He is amazing, isn't he, Wallace Stevens? As indeed is Neil. And funny enough, I'm just coming next week to the last day of my time on the second season of The Sandman. Which Netflix adapted for, and this is, as I say, the second season. And actually, when I was writing Mythos, the first of these, Neil's book on Norse mythology came out, and I read it, and it was delightful. And he's such a different sort of writer from me, and especially in this, there was the plainness of his prose, and the you know, that it's fitted so much the Norse world, the spiky, frosty world of the Norse. And so I wrote to him because I, you know, knowing him, and said, "Oh, Neil, just tell me, are you going to move on from the Norse to the Greeks? Because I'm just starting on this adventure of writing, you know, retelling Greek myths." And he returned and said, "No, it's all right, you're safe." And I wrote back and said, "And also, reading yours made me feel like, oh God, there's your Hemingway, and I'm some Edwardian, florid, you know, orotund prose stylist, and I feel very cheap and bombastic next to you." And he wrote this brilliant letter back saying, "Greece is full of fruit and flowers and life, warmth and sun, and so should be the prose that describes it, whereas I was writing in the wintry lands of the north." And he was so encouraging. And but your point is absolutely right. It's not about an intellectual claim that the Greeks have an exceptional reason to be admired by us over all people. There is no doubt that in terms of our civilization, our Western civilization, whatever you like to call it, and its massive influence on the world, you can trace so much of it to particularly 5th century BC Athens, and also so much of the iconography of it to the Greek mythology, which indeed syncretically is also incorporated into so much of Christianity in its own sort of way, you know, and shrines that were to Maya or to Aphrodite, you know, in Rome and in Greece were very sort of quickly repurposed to be to the Virgin Mary, and it was the easiest thing. It was the same place, the same spring of water, the same little, you know, dell or whatever, and the people just, you know, went to the same worship and knelt in the same way. And of course, in Easter time, the rabbits and the eggs were incorporated into the cross.
Right.
Complete dissonance between the two sets of imagery, Golgotha and a fluffy bunny and a chick, but somehow it worked. But the point, that the real point is, yes, what is it that activates that part of that lizard part of the brain that almost feels, I've been here, I know this world, it speaks to me. Perseus and Athena and Jason and Achilles, they just vibrate in one's mind in a way that for me, Loki and the northern ones didn't. And not that I don't admire Greek Norse mythology, I really do, and it's fascinating and it's fun and it's great. But it just doesn't occupy that space in the chambers of my brain that, for some reason, the Greek myths do. And even the Roman versions, I mean, I love reading Ovid, but you know, just seeing him talk about Jove and Venus and Bacchus and giving the Roman names for the gods slightly separates me from that feeling that you mention.
Another thing that I really love about mythology, oddly enough, is the relative lack of characterization. A king is a king, is an archetype, and although you could say that in the case of the Greeks, the gods are the most human creatures because they embody, you know, so many, generally speaking, of our frailties, jealousy, rage, and so on. But they are presented that way more or less archetypally. And it's actually something I find similarly appealing, maybe to a lesser degree, in Tolkien. The psychology of the individual, as Bertie Wooster would say, is relatively minor. It's the arc of the story and the collision of, let's say, great forces, you know, moral principles, evil and good, and so on. And I was pleased to have learned that one of Tolkien's key motivations in writing The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and even The Hobbit was to imagine a foundational mythology for the Anglo-Saxon people to make up for the culture that was more or less washed away by the Norman conquest. Is that something, as someone who has been the master of Lake Town, that you find a resonance? The other thing, by the way, that I like about Tolkien is his completely blithe lack of concern with the literary trends and zeitgeist of the wider literary world around him of the 20th century.
Yes, he, in common with his fellow Inklings, as they were known, those who would gather together in the pub in Oxford known as the Eagle and Child, and the best known other one was C.S. Lewis, but there was also Charles Williams, who was a very interesting poet and playwright, and they had in common with Chesterton, Chester Belloc, as he was known, Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, a kind of new wave that the Pre-Raphaelites had shown of rejection of the Blakean satanic mills and everything that followed. And to the Pre-Raphaelites, it was a being against industrialization and against the clanking machines and going back to the medieval, literally pre-Raphael world. And to the later generation of Tolkien and so on, it was a rejection of modernism and futurism and the new kind of machine age and the jagged, fragmented, fractured world, which was represented by Cubism and by the music of Stravinsky, and to them in their tweeds at Oxford was no, none of that, none of these new prose styles and verse styles. And it's not that they were against the depth of art and what art can provide, but they've wanted to find it in other places. And yes, he created his, what he called, I believe, his legendarium with precisely that aim to. And it's different, of course, because it's authored and, you know, real mythology, as it were, as opposed to whatever you want to call Tolkien. Obviously, the word fantasy is not an appealing one to admirers of Tolkien, because it sort of takes them into the Marvel comic right. world, and they don't want to be associated with that necessarily. But whatever we want to call it, I suppose the way of looking at it is that in that famous phrase of Jung's, mythology is the result of the collective unconscious, where obviously Tolkien is very consciously created, but uses the so much of the impulses and the spirit of mythology. And yeah, I mean, it is a wonderful way of telling truths about people. It's the best way, you know, because it's shorn of our current obsessions. It's very difficult now to read a modern novel, a fictional novel, that isn't sort of totally bogged down in what you might call the discourse, you know, the world of identitarian politics, racism, sexual politics, all these different elements that are so important to new generations, and by which you identify people's moral worth, and indeed their whole persona is predicated on how they are, you know, what angle they are to this new universe. Whereas if you're in the world of mythology, you're freed of that to some extent. Mm-hmm. But you're interesting too what you say about the archetypes, because there's a phrase I use in Mythos, or not a phrase, it's a whole image that I take for a walk, which may or may not stand up in some people's minds. But it starts with the gods. The first generation of gods are more than just, are less than just archetypes, I suppose. They are simply just blocky representations of what they are gods of. So Uranos, called by every delighted schoolchild Uranus, Uranos is the sky. And indeed is the Greek word for the sky to this day in modern Greek, Uranos, the sky. He is the sky. He has no personality. We don't know what his desires are. We don't know what he loves, what he hates, how he eats. He is just Uranos. And Gaia is Gaia, the earth. But the next generation of the 12 titans, six titanesses and six male titans, they have a little more. One of them is, you know, Atlas, and, you know, there's Mnemosyne, whom I mentioned, the goddess of memory. And then the next generation is what we call the gods, the 12 Olympians, plus a couple of others who didn't quite make it to Olympus, and lots of demigods and nymphs and things. And I compare it to the very first days of video games. The first one most people will remember, if they're old enough, it was called Pong. And it was basically, you just take a television screen and you plug this game into it, and you got sort of two oblongs at left and right edge of the screen going up and down, and a ball, which was actually just a square, that would bounce off the edges of the screen, and you had to move and slide your thing up with a controller, your bat. And you remember that, and it went beep, 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 beep.
I had a Pong.
You did. Exactly. Everybody did. And then the next generation, they might have introduced color. Maybe, you know, it would be RGB color, red, green, and blue, the primary colors of light. But it was still blocky, very blocky. And the next generation, the video games with Atari and Commodore, and you got these. And that was like the gods at first. They were blocky. You could sort of make out a shape, but it didn't have real personality. But as each generation, as Moore's Law and the other various advances in computer and graphic technology, suddenly we're getting anti-aliasing, where you're smoothing the steps on the edges of diagonals and curves, and you're getting these sprites and other kind of marvelous forms of refining the image, so that the resolution is increasing and increasing. And that's what happens in Greek mythology, that each generation of gods and of humans becomes more personal, until you end with the Trojan War and the survivors of the Trojan War. And it's about, you know, both with the gods and the humans, the mortals, it's sulking, it's very human, it's treachery and betrayal in very human ways that are not to do with, you know, sort of vast warrior ethics or anything, but to do with, you know, personal resentments and jealousies and so on. And the first word of the Iliad is rage. It's about rage. But there's the Odyssey, which was written later, and not all scholars are agreed it was written by the same person. That there's more than one Homer, if you like, but we give the name Homer to the bard, the rhapsode who created it. And the first description of Odysseus is polytropos, many turning, versatile, quick, nimble, able to change, sort of. Thousands of years later, E.M. Forster wrote a famous essay, well, it was a lecture originally, called Aspects of the Novel, and he came up with this now quite often used term of rounded character, the flat characters and rounded characters. Flat characters are like archetypes. You know what they think, you know what they stand for. They're almost like sort of Ben Jonson humours in humour plays, you know. But rounded characters, they can surprise you. They can do things that you didn't think they were capable of doing. And that's what, you know, that's what he saw happening in literature. More and more you would find characters who surprised you, rounded. And Odysseus is, you know, in terms of Greek literature as it had been before, a rounded character. He is surprising sometimes. And there's a modern feeling about him and about that whole work, the Odyssey, which is people find when they read it today, I think, especially in good new translations by people like Emily Wilson, who's brought a it's an exciting thing because it goes back to your Wallace Stevens idea of they came out of the weather. You know, you can imagine in the sort of beloved cave that we think of when we picture our ancestors that, you know, they've had the day's hunting and gathering and they've got fire by this time. So it's, you know, any time, whenever fire was 100,000 years ago. And maybe we're a bit nearer, I don't know, what, 70,000 to 60,000 years ago when language was developed. And so the child says to the mother, "Why, what's that noise? That noise," and it's what we would call thunder today. And they'd say, "Oh, that's the god of the sky. He's angry." Because, you know, any force you don't understand, you personalize. And whether it's thunder or even the very force that pushes blossoms and flowers through dead twigs and leaves. What is it? Why they things that change and move, and you can't see what agency they have to allow them to move. They must have an invisible agency, and our word for an invisible agency is God. Really, it's a God, right. A God that can do things, that can move things that we can't, and so that would be, you know, Demeter and Persephone, the goddesses of growth and spring, and Maya of flowers and flora, as they called her in Rome, all of that is very sort of understandable. And then as each generation of human is explaining, they become more than just an explanation for children. They become stories, you know, when suddenly you notice a connection between different things, like, you know, where do we get the ability to speak? How does someone learn to speak? And then you start talking about, well, there's the god of, you know, the god of wisdom or the god of prophecy, or, you know, and you give them characteristics that are human. As you say, the gods came out of us. And the more humans use language, so from 60,000 years ago right up to 5,000 years ago when we learned to write, to have an alphabet, in that time, which is a short span, of course, we became more sophisticated. We started to question things. We started to put pictures up. Well, we'd been putting pictures on walls for earlier, as we now discover, gets yes. earlier and earlier, the parietal art. We get more sophisticated, we get more sort of sense, we question things more, and so we make the gods far more ambiguous, far more capricious, far less just majestic creators, and more flawed beings, because we see that although the world is majestic and glorious and wise and marvelous, it's also unfair and cruel and capricious and unpredictable. So the gods who made it must be like that too, is the Greek way of looking at things. And then there's that extraordinary period, as you know, we learn to farm and sow, that when we have more leisure time because all the calories are coming to us, and a new class of person arises. And the German philosopher Karl Jaspers called it the axial age, that extraordinary time when Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, Elijah, Jeremiah, the great New Testament, the Old Testament prophets, and Confucius, and the Buddha, yes, and the founder of Jainism were all alive at, on Earth at the same time, i.e. in a short human lifespan. Suddenly, there were philosophers and theological philosophers, who were asking far more profound questions about the nature of humanity and reality than had ever been asked before, and set in train a new way for humans to be. And one result was religion, and another result, later and slower and hiccuping, sometimes along with religion, was science and the scientific approach. And all along was our favorite thing, was growing and developing, thanks to Pythagoras especially, music.
Yes, music. And speaking of music, I'll leave my references to Tolkien here, but one thing that I've always loved about Tolkien is that in his foundational myth, the beginning was not with the word, but with music, with the divine harmony. In the Silmarillion, he talks about the divine spirits creating tones, which they then create a beautiful harmony out of, and that becomes the basis for the creation of the world. And which is a nice transition to another subject, which is atheism and the sublime. Because one thing I know about you is that you have a very deep and intense relationship with the sublime in art. You're a Wagnerian, you love Mozart, you love Bach, you love great literature, you love the music of language, which I'll want to talk about as well. But so those things, but at least in an earlier part of our history, the primary inspiration for the creation of expressions that can be described as sublime, whether it's cathedrals, rose windows, great works of music, Palestrina, Bach, and so on, were always to the glory of God. Now, that's not your reality, and it's not my reality, as it happens. But this actually raises the question of whether we need something in order to actually, that is, shall we say, a mystery, in order to conjure up that experience. And without being too verbose, I'm reminded of a conversation that you had with, of all people, Jordan Peterson, which is a very odd conversation in a way, because, if
all
you don't mind my...
All conversations with Jordan Peterson are odd, right?
Well, you seem to be talking by each other, and what it amounted to was Jordan saying, but we need religion, but we have an inbuilt absolute requirement for religion. And, your response was, well, some of us do, but not all, not me. And then I think the final rejoinder, which people like Jordan really can never respond to, is whether we need it or not, if something doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. And, I'm not going to win the lottery either, but I really, really need to win the lottery. And, I'm going to go through this world, preparing for a very disappointed surprise when I come to the end point. Anyway, I'm going on a little far about that, but it raises some very interesting issues about whether, in order to capture that sense of, wonder and serenity, as Glenn Gould phrased it, we actually have something missing in our reality now that we're trying to find substitutes for.
Yes, I mean, I understand this point of view, and I sort of, let us say, sympathize, sounds a bit patronizing. I empathize. I kind of feel the same thing in some ways. You could try and make a sort of intellectual structure out of it and say, well, Plato, although he often references a god or gods, his idea of perfect forms, paradigms, the ideals that exist for everything. So whether it's the glass of water I've got on the table here, somewhere there is a perfect glass of water towards which that glass of water tends. And people who make glasses they try and make that, and there is a perfect something everywhere. And that's another way of saying it's the God. There is the sublime a perfect thing, but a perfect thing by definition is finished, is done, is over, it's perfected. And we know there is no such thing in the sublunary sphere that we inhabit, but the tending and wanting to achieve it is the energy that fuels so much art and so much of what we do. There's a great line of Robert Browning's in, I think it's in Fra Lippo Lippi, one of his dramatic monologue poems, where it's, "Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for?" And yes, there is that function of a heaven that we strive. And that's the very nature of Greek mythology. It's so much of it is about overreaching. It's about hubris being punished. It's about the fact that we move forwards. We need to. We have this goal, which is not real. And whether it's a Platonic paradigm or it's just something imagined in our head. But... there is mystery enough to me and to a good scientist. Everything is mysterious. And it's the mystery that they love, too. But there either is or is not a God. And it's if there is, the idea that it should be anything like the Hebraic or Christian version of the Hebraic or the other Abrahamic God, Allah, or any other is to me rather preposterous. why would it be the God that was invented by a small desert tribe that then split off into various factions for a while? Why wouldn't it be the animist religions that are there in the forests of Amazon or in Indonesia? These marvelous, I love those animist religions, you know, where the tree and the snake and everything has a god, as it were, has a spirit that is behind it, which is another more Platonic way of looking at it. All of that, I think, is wonderful. And has something gone out of life? Yes, if you're a certain kind of conservative, it's family values. It's the fact that sexual promiscuity and lack of discipline amongst the young has caused all the crises that we have. And for others, it's globalism. For others, it's capitalism, it's materialism. Though I rather like the Alan Watts, who was a spiritual guru. I don't know what you'd call Alan Watts, but he was very big in the 60s and 70s. He said, I cannot understand why people call it a materialist age. There has never been a time when materials were so abused. Wood and iron and steel and stone and all the materials of the earth are raped and burned and transformed and turned into horrible things. It's anti-materialist, he's saying, which is quite a good way of looking at it in a way. It's a sort of unanswerable thing. I mean, I love a lot. I love the liturgy of the Church of England, the Anglican Communion, and plenty of the Romish version too. And I'm very interested in the story of how religions came about, how the Bible was built over hundreds of years, how these variant stories were brought together, and how somehow they conned the world that this was all the work of one instant of divine revelation, when in fact it was a lot of very bureaucratic Christians sitting down and deciding what was acceptable and what wasn't. And you have to sort of then puff and say, well, each one of those meetings was divinely attended by the Paraclete. The Holy Spirit was there. And they say, okay, right, if you like. I don't think that's as good a story as all the committees meeting to finalize it. But anyway, that's all one thing. It's the human side of it. But I think of the Flaubert short story, Le Cœur Simple, the simple heart, about Félicité, this hardworking, poor woman who is devout and who kneels in front of one of those rose windows, one of those beautiful stained glass windows, and she sees these divine images and so on. And Flaubert points out that some of those figures in it are representations of rich bishops and monks who paid for the work when they were there. And the distance between the corruption of the church that she worships and the pure simplicity of her heart is to him an obscenity. And mm-hmm. and I share that view. What would the carpenter of Nazareth say if he was led down the marble colonnades of Bellini's, St. Peter's and then entered under Michelangelo's dome and entered and saw all this marble and gold and was told this was only a fraction of the treasure that was heaped up in this city, and it was all dedicated to him. He'd say, I'm sorry, understand what I was saying? Did you think that this is what I was talking about when I mentioned rich people going? And where did I talk about cathedrals, these palaces? And where did I say you could have princes of the church in red called themselves cardinal? Where did you get these ideas? Right. This has nothing to do with me. And
exactly. You have a pope who's a Medici. Or a Borgia, the money changers were driven out of the temple?
Yes, exactly. It's so funny. I mean, it's a human story, and if you follow it as such, great. But it's only when you start talking about infallibility and you look at the horror of some of the union that the Catholic Church made with juntas in South America and Central America and in their fight to beat communism. And I'm no apologist for communism, but the church made its decision that basically anything that fought communism would be its friend, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and so the fascists could be my friend. And there's a lot that one can say that's bad about the history of the church. And it's a bit strange that as it changes according to the moral discoveries of the time, that slavery is actually not a good thing. So the church, yes, we realize that now after 2,000 years, and despite the fact that the Bible seems to think it's absolutely fine, we agree. But we stand as a temple of absolutism against the world of relativism that has overtaken. Well, hang on, you now believe in evolution, you believe that Darwin and Galileo, whom you tortured, was right, you believe that science and the age of reason and the Enlightenment have given us a new set of moral principles of equality of races that you never held before. These were all discovered outside the church, and you preach that anything that was outside the church was outside holiness, and only things within, you add little Latin phrases to say only that which is within the church is acceptable. And now you say that you still stand for absolutism, because what's going to happen when the morals about animals change more and more over the next 50 years? You'll suddenly produce a papal bull or some sort of document, Lateran 19 or whatever you'll call it, which will say it is terrible to keep animals in zoos. And where will you have learned that? Not from the Bible, not from your own doctrines, but from outside.
Exactly. Well, our values are absolute, relatively speaking. I'm sorry, this is probably very blasphemous, but as Humpty Dumpty said, words mean whatever I choose them to mean. And it's very interesting, though, that the course of history and the history of art, at least, let's say, from the period that followed the Black Death, in other words, the birth of the Renaissance, is an incredible intermingling of the most sublime and the most obscene. There's a wonderful book called The Ugly Renaissance. I don't know if you've ever come across it, but it's about the relationship between the noble families of Renaissance Italy and what absolute blighters they were. In fact, they were essentially the equivalent of mafia clans, but with exquisite taste. And, when you, I think it was Julius II who began the whole, St. Paul's and the Sistine Chapel and so on. And this was the idea of restoring the place of Rome from being kind of a broken down swampland into the heart of Christendom. And this required, decorating it with the most extraordinary art, which caused the need for an extraordinary amount of money, which caused the selling of indulgences, which caused the Reformation, which caused hundreds of years of war and prejudices which still persist to this day.
Yeah, right. They missed out an important Northern European element to that, which I find very interesting. One of the things the Black Death caused naturally was a sense of what have we done wrong. A third of one in three of us has died from how did we anger God? So there was this huge rise of pilgrimages to go and cleanse the soul. And the most famous, of course, being, I suppose, the Canterbury Tales, but there were others as well. So about towards the end of the 14th century, the 1380s and 90s, that this, you know, really took off. And then throughout the early 15th century, from 1400 all the way up, people were going on pilgrimages. And there was an entrepreneur from the sort of Germany-French border who sold these little silver boxes that you put up as periscopes, because at the back of Santiago Compostela, which is, you know, one of the main pilgrimage points in Europe, they'd go down through France, past the new cathedrals that were being built, and to this great one in Spain, where the bones of St. James the Apostle were. And they were so crowded every day with that some people couldn't see the relics as they were held up by the head of the church, you know, whoever it was. And so he invented this light periscope with a mirror on it, so the light went from it, and then it went down. But then he was doing quite well with it, but there was another plague, so he thought, "What else can I invent?" And he'd had this idea about making. He'd seen print blocks using, you know, woodcuts, where you could reprint something time and time again by pressing the woodblock to paper. And he thought, suppose you could move that, you know, you could do that with letters, but actually move them. And so he because he was good with metals, his name was Gansfleisch, which means goose flesh, but he changed it to Gutenberg. Anyway, the story. By 1450, he wanted to get the Pope on his side, because the Pope was in control of so much of what was allowed and wasn't allowed. And of course, everything written was done by monks in scriptoria. So he said, look, you've got a holy year coming up, it's 1450. I can print indulgences. So, you know, these things that were painstakingly written out by monks, which were sort of the equivalent of a carbon offset, sin offset. You know, you pay $1,000 and you can, you know, masturbate in public for 2 weeks and you won't go to hell. Or you pay $10,000, you can, goodness knows what you can do. You know, so you pay your money and it's an advance on some sin you're going to, it's an indulgence. But if you can print them, and the Pope's going, wow, this is literally a license to print money, because an indulgence was the equivalent of a banknote. So, and he said, yes, you can print those, and yes, you can do your Bible if you like. And little did he know that from there being no printed books in the world in 1450, by 1480 there were 12 million. By 1500, you know, you could triple that. And by 1515, when Martin Luther, as you say, started to complain about these indulgences and pinned his proclamations on the wall, the book was being used. The printed book was the weapon. It was the Twitter of its age, because it worked in both directions. It's has no moral valency. The same printing press can print the sonnets of Shakespeare one day and Mein Kampf the next. It doesn't know. And similarly, it could print pro-Protestant and it could print pro-Catholic. And so it was seeding hatred and resentment and false information and all the rest of it. And, you know, before long, there were all the right up to the 30 Years' War in the 17th century and so on. So yeah, it was both those bankers, as you say. I mean, they all feed into that same story, don't they? Because as Cranmer said in his introduction to the Book of British Prayer, there was not anything by the wit of man devised that hath not been in part, in time or in whole, corrupted. And it's that, the sense that we, whatever it is, these ideals we have, we corrupt them. Listen, I can't bear the idea of tearing myself away from you, Brian. It's always so fun to talk to you.
Well, it's been delightful, and I you've been very generous with your time. Obviously, we have a standing invitation. I can tell you that I had 12 questions, and we reached number 2 on the list. So
I am so awful.
Not at all. But I mean, there's so many things I want to talk to you about: free speech and cancel culture, and of course, we haven't even touched on Woodhouse or Wilde. So those are perhaps future pleasures that we can anticipate.
The WWs, absolutely.
Yes. All right. Oh, thank you so much, Stephen.
Great. Thank you.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.